to them with a problem.
Well, then he has to, see, because his program is funded under.
The Senate Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness will come to order. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You'll notice that I have an orchid.
You said 48.
Go ahead.
You notice that I have an orchid here, and this is in memory of Seth Sprague. As you know, Senator Boquist and his wife tragically lost their child last Wednesday, and I felt most important thing for me to do today and for this committee is to let the senator know how deeply we feel for the loss of your son.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Thank you very much. Colleagues, we're going to start with the House concurrent resolutions. If you recall, Representative Olson was here last time, and we didn't get to them. And what we're going to do is open a public hearing on House concurrent resolution 201, 202, 203, 205, and 207. And good representative, would you like counsel here to tee it up, or can you just lead?
I can do it.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson, and I'm the representative from the Albany Area House District 15. I do greatly appreciate this opportunity to come before you to share these five House concurrent resolutions. And Chair Boquist, honestly, I'm sorry for your loss, and prayers have been with you big time in the last few days, so for you and Peggy. House concurrent 201 is Anthony Justison. He was born on April 4th, 1988 in Portland, Oregon. He graduated from the Oregon National Guard Youth Challenge Program on December 15th, 2005, and then worked for the next few years deciding what to do and make his life meaningful. In the process, he joined the Army on October 8th, 2008 and served in the 82nd Airborne Division 4th Brigade Combat Team. He was killed on June 23, 2010, 1 month before completing his tour of Afghanistan, when insurgents attacked his unit with an explosive device. The next House concurrent resolution is 2002. That is Travis Moothart. And Travis was born in Corvallis, Oregon on February 3, 1980. He grew up in Brownsville area, graduated from Central Lynn High School in 1998, and went on to study mechanics at Lynn Benton Community College. He enlisted in the Army in 2000 and put his knowledge of mechanics to use while serving in South Korea and then eventually on to Iraq. He was killed by a roadside bomb on January 27, 2004. And I just want to make a note here that the Brownsville American Legion Post have named their facility after him, and there is also a Moothart Memorial Scholarship at Central Lynn High School that's given during graduation. House Concurrent Resolution 203 is regarding Eric Kesterson. And Eric was born March 10, 1974 in San Jose, California. He graduated from Vernonia High School and joined the Marine Corps in 1992. Now he has a little bit more of a colorful background, as I'll read share with here. He was a gunner on Hueys and Cobras during the UH-1 crew chief and achieved the rank of staff sergeant in short order. On September 12, 2000, he was a gunner and crew chief on a Huey that went down, and he pulled seven fellow Marines from the burning helicopter before it exploded. He left the Marines in 2001. Shortly thereafter, when 9/11 occurred, he volunteered again to serve his country, this time in the United States Army. He qualified for the Warrant Officer Flight Training Program and became a Black Hawk helicopter pilot for the 101st Airborne Division. He was deployed to Mosul, Iraq, with B Company 9th Battalion, 101st Aviation Regiment on November 7th, when he was killed 8 days later when his helicopter went down, bringing a striker team in to support troops under fire. House Concurrent Resolution 205 is about Cody James Patterson. And Cody was born April 12th, 1989 in Corvallis, Oregon. He spent his childhood primarily in the Philomath, Benton County area. He was very active in his church, especially at Peace Lutheran Church there. He was a civic-minded young man and captain of his high school football team. He graduated from Philomath High School in 2007 and went on to work while also attending Lynn Benton Community College before joining the United States Army in 2011. He completed the basic airborne course, graduated from RASP, which is the Ranger Assessment Selection Program, and was assigned to Company B, 3rd Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment, where he served as a rifleman for both of his deployments to Afghanistan. He was killed by an improvised explosive device on October 6, 2013, during combat operations in Kandahar province in support of Operation Enduring Freedom. And then the final House Concurrent Resolution 207 is about Donald Walters. And this is really, I mean, they're all sad, but I'm very proud of all these men, too, as well. And you get this. But this was the tough one. Donald Walters was born September 16, 1969, in Colorado Springs, Colorado. The family moved to Oregon in 1981, and he graduated from North Salem High School in 1988. He followed in his father's footsteps when he joined the United States Army, and he served during the Persian Gulf War guarding Iraqi prisoners. After 1991, he was in and out of the Army for a time, coping with his experiences. But after September 11th, he renewed himself to serve his country once again. He was captured by Iraqi fighters near Nasiriyah, Iraq, and executed on March 23, 2003. So, Mr. Chair and committee members, in accordance with what we've done in this legislative body over the past several years and moving forward with either a House concurrent resolution or a Senate concurrent resolution to identify these folks with placing a sign out on a highway recognizing them, this is our movement toward them and recognizing them and appreciating and honoring them.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair? Chair Olson?
Yes. Representative?
I can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative, you and I get a lot of each other's mail. I don't know how you can do five of these at one time. I have trouble getting through one. But thank you for supporting these folks. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Senator Olson.
Any questions? Thank you, Representative, and I appreciate the suggested list of carriers for the bills. Anything with that? With that, we're going to close the public hearing on 201, 202, 203, 205, 207, and open a work session on House Concurrent Resolution 201. Madam Vice Chair?
Chair Boquist, I move HCR 201 to the floor with a B adopted recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair, Monica Henderson moves HCR 201 to the floor with a B adopted. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. With that, we'll close the work session on 201 and open a work session on 202. Madam Vice Chair?
Chair Bokos, I move HCR 202 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves HCR 202 to the floor with a do adopted. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. We're going to ask Senator Beyer to carry 202. If not, I will carry it. Madam Vice Chair, will you carry 201? Thank you. With that, we're going to close 202 and open a work session on HCR 203. Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Bokus, I move HCR 203 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair, Monis Anderson moves HCR 203 to the floor with a do adopted. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? We're going to ask Senator Johnson to carry that, and I'll carry it if she doesn't. So ordered. We're going to close the work session on 203 and open a work session on HCR 205. Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Boquist, I move HCR 205 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves HCR 205 to the floor with a do adopted. Any discussion? Any opposition? We're going to ask Senator Gilmore to carry that. Senator Olson, would you be the second on that if
Absolutely.
She cannot?
Yes.
With that, we're going to close the work session HCR 205 and open a work session on HCR 207.
Chair Boquist, I move HCR 207 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair, Monis Anderson moves HCR 207 to the floor with a do adopt. Any discussion? Any opposition?
Senator Courtney, would you be kind enough to carry that bill?
I will.
Thank you. With that, we're going to close the work session on HCR 205, go back to the top of our calendar, colleagues, and open a public hearing on HB 4097A. If you would, please, Mr. Roper.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4097A permits the Office of Emergency Management to enter into agreements with the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs for the purpose of operation of the tribe's public safety answering point.
Well, Chair Borquist and members of the Senate Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee, thank you for hearing this bill today. My name is Michael Mason. I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. House Bill 4097 is an important, though small, bill authorizing the Office of Emergency Management to make an agreement with the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs for a 911 jurisdiction. Now, what's interesting is Warm Springs has had a 911 point, or PSAP as they're called, for 17 years now. And we had thought that this was getting taken care of in a bill last year, but apparently it did not. And we're back to making sure that it's clear that authority exists for what we're already doing.
For 17 years.
For 17 years. And apparently successfully, we get over 2,000 calls a year to the 911 point. Prior to this, people had to call Condon. The folks in Condon didn't necessarily know where people were. A lot of the elders at Warm Springs will identify by their first names. They figure they're calling somebody, like when they call the police or fire at Warm Springs, who know who they are and know the terrain and know where the dead spots are in terms of cell coverage and such. I won't go on and on, but this unanimously passed the House, carried by our representative, John Huffman. So appreciate your consideration and hope we can, or hope you'll see fit to move the bill to the floor. Thank you.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I'm Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. Appreciate the opportunity to speak here today. We're in support of House Bill 4097. This basically codifies some past practice that we've had. As Mr. Mason described, we attempted to get this resolved in legislation during the 15th session. It did not work out as we were hoping for. As Mr. Mason's described, this PSAP has been in concert, has been operating since 1999. 17 years they've been a PSAP. They've been one of those that we've always counted as a PSAP. We want to make certain that we're able to enter into an agreement in order to help provide the training and the materials necessary to ensure that those consoles, those telecommunicator training requirements, et cetera, are met. Our intent is that in this agreement that this PSAP operates as the other 42 operate. There's language in here that they'll be treated the same. And so from that standpoint, we certainly appreciate your support and hope that we can move this forward. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
I'm just curious, I mean, who was it that suddenly decided after 17 years, oh, wow, we didn't have the right paperwork? I'm just curious. Not opposed to the bill, I'm just curious. It took 17 years to say, oh, wow.
And Chair Boquist, there's a history behind it. There's a history in agreements between the counties and the PSAP, Warm Springs PSAP. There certainly are consistencies and inconsistencies that existed with OEM. And quite frankly, we just want to just codify this practice and move forward.
Vice Chair, questions?
Senator Alden.
Senator Courtney. Well, thank you. Is there anybody else that wants to testify? Nobody knows the 17-year history? Okay, good. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4097A, an open work session. Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Boquist, I move House Bill 4097A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves House Bill 4097A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Madam Vice Chair. Senator Olson, Senator Courtney. Opposition? Oh, I suppose we should call the roll just to be official.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Monis Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Boquist?
Yes. The motion carries. Just in case somebody after 17 years questions, you know, something else here.
Okay.
And Senator Olson has volunteered to carry this bill. It should be easy. We've been doing it for 17 years. We're just going to do it for 18. That's all. With that, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 4097. Colleagues, we have a short informational meeting. If you want to stay around, is for an update on emergency access to the coast in our continued march for preparedness. And I think what we'll do is move straight into that and ask Mr. Stuckey and Captain Samuels and Mr. Mather all to come up. One big happy team. Colleagues and members of the public, I think, as you know, there are lands that are being privatized and changing environments in the 21st century. And since we're trying, at some point we'll have a state resilience officer, and we're moving down the road of responding to things on the coast. I believe you know that Mr. Mather has not found a golden pumpkin or a rainbow to create new roads, so we have to use the existing systems we have. So the issue that's come up is just to be able to identify and ensure there's coordination for roads that we don't own that might be in the private sector or with the Department of Forestry or everybody else, that we actually have access to those when those bridges that aren't in the seismic program fall on the ground. So I'm happy to let anyone start. Well, I notice they always pass it to you, right?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I'm Dave Stuckey. I'll keep my comments brief. Deputy Director for the Oregon Military Department. You know, you raise an excellent point, Chair Boquist, in terms of responding to emergency. And not to go into great detail, but there's air, land, and sea in which we're going to be able to respond into any kind of emergency, whether it's the Cascadia unzipping or it's some other type of action. And so certainly from our standpoint, we spent a great deal of effort on the air side. We see aircraft, helicopters, as well as fixed wing as being a principal means to get our support, medical supplies, fuel, et cetera, over to the coast. In terms of a Cascadia. And then at the same time, we also see the sea approach. As you saw in the Tohoku EQ in 2011, that the United States Navy was there fairly quickly within a couple of days to help support. And so there's multiple prongs, there's multiple approaches in which we do this. Quite frankly, we rely on ESF-1 and our partners at ODOT in terms of the ground transportation piece. We know there's been a lot of great work done on it. We certainly want to help be a part of that process and practice. And their approach in terms of the seismic lifelines and the road networks and what we need in that long-term approach, certainly we'd be happy here to say that, you know, give us the $50 billion that we need to harden our highways this year versus the next 50 years.
That was B with a billion, wasn't it?
Yes, sir. I was mumbling. I apologize. Okay. But from the standpoint of all seriousness, we certainly have this multi-pronged approach, and the ground transportation piece is absolutely critical. There's lots of little pieces that could go into this, but with that, I think I would be happy to stop here and pass it off to someone else.
It's just professional state trooper. Always put everybody out in front of you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. Just to correct the record, it's actually $5 billion, not $50 billion that we need for our study. You remember, I was before your committee. I think a couple years ago we presented that plan to you of just our overall approach to deal with both landslides and bridges and armor up our lifeline routes for access to the coast. Also, I'm sure as you know, we at ODOT deal with emergencies regularly. We've dealt with several already this winter and deal with floods, deal with windstorms, snowstorms, and preparing for major earthquakes as well. We work with our partners, whether it's OSP, emergency management, local partners, in responding to those and to the particulars of the situation that are set forth that are in front of us. We use the National Incident Management System to follow those protocols and work with our partners and work through the particulars of the situation. One of the questions that has come up is authority. So who has authority to go beyond the state highways, beyond our authority at ODOT, to maybe take on private logging roads or other private roads in the case of an emergency. We have specific authorities to get onto private properties relative to our highway and to maintain and keep our highway open during emergencies. The governor, as you know, has broad authority both in the Constitution and in statute. We believe that between our authority and the governor's authority in a major earthquake such as Cascadia, we would have the property authority to get onto private roads. The question really becomes more of what condition are they going to be in? Are they going to be in any better condition than our highways? And what are the particulars of the situation that we're faced with? So let me share with you maybe a couple examples already this winter of how we've utilized private roads in responding to emergencies. In December, we had a major rain event that had floods and washed out several culverts. One of those was on Cape Mears. The community of Oceanside has access by a state highway. As you loop around Cape Mears, it turns into a county road looping back to Tillamook. Prior to this winter, from other damage, the county portion of that roadway had been closed already. During the storm, we lost a culvert, thus isolating the community of Oceanside for several days. Working with emergency providers in that community, they gained access through a series of private logging roads to get access. That access was monitored and limited pretty severely to just emergency situations. It was not, for example, just put a sign up, say, detour, and putting all traffic over onto logging road, but it was we use pilot cars, escorts, so forth, to get people through in those emergency situations. And that's really how we see it playing out in most emergencies. I do not know of a situation where we simply just allowed general traffic to use another road, whether it be a county road or a private road. There's many vehicles that are on a state highway that have height, weight, other restrictions to them, and to turn just general traffic over onto another road that we don't have jurisdiction of, we've got to be very, very sensitive to. And so usually when we are detouring traffic off of our highway onto any road, we're putting some kind of parameters in place to ensure the safety of that vehicle as well as others using that facility, and using a private road would be no exception. We've also had great cooperation in working with private landowners in those situations, like I described at Oceanside, but also this last winter we had a similar situation near Vernonia on Highway 47, where we also worked with our local partners and local landowners to provide limited access, but some access for emergency vehicles and others to get around either slides, washouts, down trees, and so forth to move essential supplies or emergency personnel from one side of the incident to the other. So hopefully that gives you some context of how we typically work through the issues.
So, Chair Boquist and committee members, good afternoon. Jeff Samuels, Oregon State Police, Fish and Wildlife Division. I'll just briefly go into what my partners have said up here, in that the state police, we do locally work with our partners and the other state agencies to facilitate, you know, in times of emergency. We do have some small air assets for airplanes. We have a boat fleet, you know, across the state and in different locations, so those could be mobilized. And then we just work, you know, on the ground with our county sheriffs and local police and ODOT and other state partners to affect, you know, help in those emergency situations. I can also say for Fish and Wildlife Division, relative to land ownership, private land ownership in the Coast Range, we do have keys to many of the gates on some of that private property to enforce laws that occur on those locations, and also to enforce hunting and angling laws that occur there. So, whether the laws relative to opening up that piece of property, I'd kind of defer to what ODOT said. Not sure of the exact law to just allow us to open up that property for access, and would be also concerned about the condition of the roads if we were to consider that option to get to or from the coast.
Thank you. A couple of questions, I guess an observation. So committee members
can grasp this. And what you're specifically speaking to, Captain, is the travel management agreements along the Oregon coast. I mean, most of the private lands fall under Department of Fish and Wildlife, and most of them, as you know, have travel management areas. And for emergency access, and I'll give a couple examples in the end, I mean, you should be encouraged to get ODF and W, state parks, and other people who own lands to work together in a team effort so that if we're writing travel management agreements with corporations and forestry sector people in exchange for benefits, like patrolling and gates and things like that, that we ensure we have in those contracts clauses that do allow the emergency access. Those coastal lands, of course, as I think everybody knows, Weyerhaeuser has already put about a third of their lands into private hunting areas that are fully gated. You buy recreational passes to get on and off the property, and it's gated, so on and so forth like that. And as we move towards that trend, which I know Oregon has opposed that trend for decades, the rest of the country is already there, so it's just a matter of time. And it's a matter of making that coordination between those. And then, of course, the other issue is that if 40% of the population just doesn't happen to be around anymore, how many of the troopers with keys are going to be around, and Paul's going to have to get his cats out and rip those gates out of the road to go out there? I think that's one of the key issues out there. And colleagues, if you're not aware, I mean, there are some things that several of the departments are working at correcting. I mean, unfortunately, there's through decades, maybe 40 years, 60 years, I think, 60 years, some there are gates that are owned by the private sector that have ended up in the middle of state parks that are posted no trespassing private property, and in fact, they're public property, and some of those things that are being corrected as we speak now. So that the population doesn't get cited or other things like that. But I think with state parks, ODF and W, working with three of you, we should be able to identify and continue to get access to those roads. But they're going to be privatized, and I think Weyerhaeuser has moved that way. Hancock has got some of that moving. There's various companies that have signaled that they're going to close those roads down. And since they cover virtually every stick of land from the Columbia to the California border, it behooves us to start now, especially since we just did a 17-year-old PSAP, and Mr. Mather will tell you the gates we're talking about were installed in 1941. So I would encourage cooperation, and I think somebody back there is from ODF and W and Parks, and kind of getting a grasp around this so that we have that access when we need it to the coast is going to be, you know, critical in the future. And there are several of our colleagues that were surprised, like Senator Johnson, of some of the things that were happening out there. So, but I thank you, gentlemen. I will let State Parks off the hook today and ODF and W as we kind of go forward. Senator Olson.
Well, gosh, you can't let me get away without asking a question. And I want to get just a little technical because I want to see exactly where we're at, if you guys don't mind. And if you can't answer the question, that's fine because, you know, I don't know that you're probably prepared for this. But, Mr. Mather, as far as highways, I mean, if assuming we have the big tsunami, as far as the highways go, could I assume correctly that everyone east to west would be unusable?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yes, I think that's a safe assumption. With a 9.0 or greater earthquake, our models are showing obviously severe damage to Highway 101, but every major corridor to the coast as well will be in some way inhibited.
A follow-up to that, please. Do you have, Mr. Mather, do you have, I know you do, but I just want to clarify this, have heavy equipment stationed on the coast side of the Cascade Range or the coast range? It's that you could use that to implement clearing any roads that are available?
Senator Boquist, Senator Olson, yes, we have equipment in our maintenance yards. We have ongoing agreements with private contractors, cooperative agreements with other governments. The question really is our access to those, their availability, their condition, our employees, all those other variables during such a major event, and where are we going to be able to you know, muster the resources to get to those areas that need to be cleared.
A follow-up, please. What would be the chain of command if there was an event? That who would be the person on the coast in any particular city that would be that person that could mobilize those forms of people to get at least maybe clear stuff out of a road where we could have a major road to move on. Who would be the chain of command, or what would be the chain of command?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, we work under the county emergency management structure and the state emergency management structure, so that's formally the process we'd work under. However, given the event that we're talking about, very likely in the short term, there's not going to be communications to have that. Our crews have shown, even in minor situations, they are very determined and very dedicated to get out there and start clearing what's right in front of them.
Follow-up?
Please.
So basically, you have the ability to have these guys go into the field and hire people and make them move because you have all the
correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Captain Samuels, how many police officers do you have on the coast, state police officers? I hate to put you on the spot.
No. Senator Boquist and Senator Olson, for the Fish and Wildlife Division, we have roughly about 35. And for patrol division, I would just be making a guess at this point. I can get back to you with that number, though, for sure.
Just make a guess.
75.
75?
Yeah.
So about 110 total on the coast.
Correct.
And I guess, sir, follow up.
Please.
Same question to you, then. How does the chain of command begin? And I know these folks they're going to be impacted by this stuff, too, but I know that... And they're going to be torn between, you know, taking care of family and taking care of what needs to be taken care of. So how does that chain of command on your side start out when the disaster strikes?
Sure. So we do have, we would use the incident command system with other local law enforcement, and then also individually for each area command that's along the coast. There would be a chain of command within that area for that either area command office or work sites. Relative to that particular area.
Yeah, follow up?
Please.
Since we wouldn't have radio connection, most likely, would an officer, say, in Florence be able to work independently without having to get oversight from Salem to be able to say, I need to do this, I need to block this off, or I need to do that? Would he be able to do that on his own?
Chair and then Senator Olson, yes, they would be able to do that.
Good, thank you. And Mr. Stuckey, if you don't mind, sir.
He's gotten off free today so far.
Yeah, he's gotten off free, so we'll start whacking at him a little bit. You talked about the assets and the air assets and stuff like that. So my question is this. We know that most of the airports over there are at or a little above sea level, so they really wouldn't be functional to use. So how would we use fixed-wing air assets to get any material in there?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, there are facilities that are airports that can operate. Camp Blanco comes to mind right off the top, and so typically you are correct if you're implying that rotary wing assets, helicopters, is the best route, and I would agree with you. It could land anywhere, and we could set up a FARP or fuel point anytime, any place with a helicopter. But be that as it may, it's the fixed wing assets that's going to really bring in all the heavy stuff. It's really going to bring in the food and supplies that we're going to need, and so we'll just do it based upon assessment of the airports. And so there may be one or two that are working, maybe airdrop, may in fact just be helicopter.
Follow up,
please.
And I know you had mentioned that the Navy, you know, there was opportunity to use the Navy, but if we had that 9-0 on our coast, you know, the whole west coast of the United States is in deep trouble. Could you foresee any time span that they would be able to get in to try to assist us? Because some of the fleet would probably be stuck down in port because of what happened.
Yeah. Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, good question. It is going to be based upon circumstances. It's going to be based upon whether or not certain aircraft or certain naval craft is actually out to sea or not. I wouldn't anticipate any type of force landing because there's going to be so much debris out there in the ocean that it's just going to be impossible. But can a helicopter medical ship stationed off the coast help resupply and helicopter capability just like a helicopter from Salem would to the coast? Yes. And so it's going to be totally situationally dependent on what's available and what's out there. Are there plans? Have we had those discussions? Has FEMA been a part of that whole process on what big DOD can do to help support us? Absolutely. And there's contingency planning for that.
Follow-up, please. You mentioned something that just kind of struck me, and I need to ask this question. You had mentioned that a hospital ship off the coast. Do we have, or do you know, if the big one happens and we get the big wave, what kind of little waves will we get, or can those ships operate after the tsunami happens and goes away?
Hey, Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, the effects of a Cascadia on the ocean surface, I would actually defer to someone else on that.
Okay.
But be that as it may, what did we see immediately after the Tohoku EQ in 2011? We saw naval ships operate safely off the coast days within the event. The issue happened to be, you know, in terms of debris and that type of thing in the ocean as much as anything.
Thank you.
And I just will remind everybody, and the choke point for recovery still remains to be fuel. We run out of communications in 24 hours because the generators run dry on the cell towers. And the fuel work group, will point out, and once again that I publicly complimented before, that the Department of Transportation and their independent operations you're talking about, Senator Olson down there, have come up with some fairly creative ways to get fuel out of the ground, if not out of their tanks. And so at least the 4,000 or 5,000 gallons that the ODOT crews along each highway have, I think they'll have access to. Which, you know, the state police better pay attention here because there won't be any place for them to get their stuff. And hopefully if something comes out of the card lock bill that we're doing, then the military department will have access to hundreds of thousands, actually millions of gallons of underground fuel to do it. But the choke point remains fuel. We go dry in 24 hours.
Sure.
So with or without roads, gates, or whatever else. So something for us to continue to work on. All right, colleagues. 35-day session. I think we all have things to do. Appreciate it, gentlemen, for coming and giving us a brief.
Thank you.
And with that, we are finished for the day.